thought the neighbors at our end of the ditch were in a good position to collect for the loss of their crops. I asked him if he wasn't afraid there was going to be some shooting that year, as there had been the first year we moved here. But he said,
"There would be, if we tried to take the law into our own hands. But few men will shoot at law-abiding people. If Fred and Mr. Wright can keep the hotheads quiet, I think everything will be all right. Anyway, worrying won't help it a bit, so let's get Mother to fix us up a lunch, and we'll spend the day down by the creek."
We had another fine day down at the creek. I don't remember what Mother read that day, but I do remember getting her to recite Thanatopsis, and that she was looking right at me when she said,
"So live, that when thy summons comes..."
She said each word slow and clear, and the "thy" rung like a stroke on a heavy bell. I did not go back to Cooper's that night till after the milking. If I had something I needed to talk to Father about, and did not want anybody else to know, milking time was when we always talked. Most of the nights, though, we did not talk at all. We didn't that night. I don't know how to tell it, but there was something nice about being out there alone with him and smelling the cow's smell and hearing the milk go singing into the buckets. Sometimes, it is nicer not to talk when you are near somebody that you love. Father helped me saddle Sky High when I had to go. He did not do it as if I were a little boy and had to be helped, but the same way he would have done it with Fred Altland or any other man. I had never waited till so late in the day to get on Sky for the first time, and I did not know if he'd buck or not. So I told Father not to be afraid if he was a little frisky, because he wasn't mean. I could not get my foot into the stirrup from the ground, but High had taught me how to hop and catch the saddle horn and stirrup at the same time. Once in a while, Sky High started his leap before I got clear up, and then I had to do it all over again. But that night, I guess he knew I wanted to show off for Father, and he did not rear till I was all set. He only crow-hopped a few jumps, and then we waited for Father. He walked out to the gate with me, as he always did, but the only things he said were that he was proud of the way I had trained Sky High, and it would be best to put lots of cream in my coffee. He waved to me as he closed the gate and called,
"So long, partner."
Chapter 28. Riding in the Roundup.
Riding Hay Rake and Stacker Horse were kind of monotonous after being at the mountain ranch with High and the cattle. If it hadn't been for the evenings, I don't think I would have liked it at all. Before High went back to the mountains, he told me that I would have to ride Sky High every night if I wanted him to remember all of the things I had taught him during the spring, and that I ought to keep him in practice on cutting and roping by working on the young stock in the home pasture. There were about 20 men around the place during haying. 8 or 9 of them were cowhands who were not needed with the stock through the summertime, and the rest were hands that Mr. Cooper had hired in Denver. All the cowhands were getting ready for the 4th of July roundup at Littleton. They always had roundups at the fairgrounds on 4th of July and Labor Day, and there were prizes for bronc busting, horse racing, trick riding, and roping. Mr. Cooper liked to have the YB fellows win prizes at the roundups, and he kept 10 or 12 outlaw horses at the home place so the men could keep in practice. I wanted to try to ride a couple of them. They didn't seem to buck as hard as Prince used to, but Mr. Cooper would not let me. Every night, he had one of the fellows ride with me when I was practicing with Sky High. Usually, it was Tom Brogan. Well, he wasn't very good at busting, but he could make a rope do more funny tricks than a monkey on a grapevine. I learned to do some rope tricks from him, but he could not make his old sorrel do tricks like High's Blue, and I never could seem to keep Sky in step with him. Mr. Cooper had High come in from the mountain ranch about the end of June, so he could get some practice on the outlaws before the roundup. From then till the 4th, High practiced with me 3 or 4 hours a day. Mr. Cooper saw us riding together that first night after I came in from the mountains, and after that he'd send Tom Brogan to ride the stacker horse at about 3 in the afternoon, and I had all of the rest of the day with High. There wasn't any haying on the 4th of July, and everybody went to the roundup early in the forenoon. I rode Sky High, and I didn't have to stay in the grandstand either, like the other kids. High took me right out into the middle of the racetrack oval, where they had the bronco busting and bulldogging and calf roping. High won first prize in the bronco busting, and Tom Brogan in calf roping. But it was the trick riding that I liked the best. One girl crawled clear around her horse under his belly and back into the saddle while he was on the dead run. Another one stood with her feet in loops of strap on the saddle pommel and rode all the way around the racetrack without losing her balance. And there were at least a dozen men riders who did all kinds of stunts, from going under a running horse to sliding off over one's tail and jumping back into the saddle. After everything else was over, the man with the megaphone shouted,
"The last number on our program will be an exhibition of matched pair riding by High Beckman and Little Britches of the YB Spread. Bring 'em out, High."
High had not told me we were going to ride. Tom Brogan picked me up by one arm and the hind end of my chaps and tossed me into my saddle, but my legs were shaking so that I could hardly get my feet into the stirrups. And then somebody opened the gate and let us out onto the racing strip in front of the grandstand. It was a good thing I'd had those few afternoons to ride with High, because I was so mixed up at first that Sky High pretty nearly had to do everything by himself. I didn't help him much till it came to the end, where we went up to the grandstand changing lead, so that it looked as if both horses were dancing. As we went up, High said,
"Grab your hat off, Little Britches, when you see me grab mine."
I did, and the people in the stands yelled louder than they did when Fred Altland's bays won the trotting race. All I could think of was that I wished Father could have been there to hear it. All of the YB fellows went uptown to Monahan's saloon as soon as the roundup was over, and I went with them. Sky High didn't like going up the main street very well, and kept bobbing his head and dancing. But it was the doctor's horseless carriage that really scared him. He crow-hopped right up onto the sidewalk in front of Schellenberger's Market, and he was still trembling when I left him ground-tied at the hitch rail by Monahan's. I was about as nervous as Sky High, because I knew Mother wouldn't want me going into the saloon. Anyway, not unless I had to go in to see the sheriff. High sat me up on the middle of the bar, and lots of fellows came and shook hands with me and called me Little Britches, and wanted to buy me birch beer and sarsaparilla. But all the time I seemed to be hearing Mother's voice, as it was down there by the creek when she recited,
"So live, that when thy summons comes."
I had to talk about something to get that out of my head, so I said to High,
"I'll bet we could do some stunts pretty near as good as those trick riders. I can do that diving trick and come up on my feet like you did when Mother and I were planting potatoes."
And then I told him about practicing it in the sandy spot when I was herding Mrs. Corcoran's cows. When we got back to the home ranch, everyone wanted to see me do it, even Mr. Cooper. And I almost wished I hadn't said anything about it. With Fanny, I'd always done the diving stunt bareback, and she never spooked or changed direction when I was starting my dive. I knew it would be a lot different to do it from a saddle, and was afraid I might get a foot caught in a stirrup or that Sky High might spook so that I'd land square on my head. I guess High was thinking about the same things. Anyway, he would not let me try it till we went way out into the middle of a plowed field, and then he led Sky High the first couple of times. I had not tried the stunt since about a month before we lost Fanny, and Sky didn't run very well in the plowed ground, so I kind of messed up the first couple of tries. After that, High let me try it alone, and it went better. From there on to the end of August, I don't think I always gave the man who was paying me a good day's work, the way Father told me to. High went back to the mountain ranch with the cattle, and we hardly got one cutting of alfalfa put up before another was ready to be started. But a couple of mornings every week, Mr. Cooper would say he had to go up to the mountains to see how the cattle were getting along, and that I could go with him if I wanted to. Of course, I always wanted to. And High would spend 2 or 3 hours practicing stunts with me. There were only two of them that were hard to learn, and we practiced them both 12 times whenever I went to the mountains and on Saturday afternoons when High came into the home place. For one of them, High would have me stand facing him, and then he would take Sky Blue back 100 yards to give him a good start, and then come pounding down past me. As he came, he'd lean over in the saddle and stick one arm out straight. I'd stick my arm out straight, too. If I kicked my off leg up just at the instant our arms met, and if we got a handhold on each other's arms, I'd go flying right up back of his cantle. The trouble was that I had to kick my leg up before our arms really came together. Whenever they missed, or we didn't get a good handhold, I'd turn a somersault without using my arms. My face got skinned up a little at first, but after a few days I'd sail up back of the saddle nearly every try. The only other hard one was the one where High swung me. We practiced that one first with a jockey pole between the two horses' bridles, so they would have to run side by side without any guiding. We tied our lines around the saddle horns, and when the horses were going lickety-cut, I'd put both arms over my head and lean toward High. He'd lean toward me with one arm looped up over his head, and we'd get a wrist hold, and then he would jerk me out of my saddle and swing me over his head so that at the top of the swing, I was doing a handstand at the end of his upstretched arm. I had to bounce and jump when my feet hit the ground on the offside of the horse, so that he could swing me back into my own saddle again. It wasn't nearly as hard as it was scary, and we only made 2 or 3 bobbles before it worked as smooth as a stream of warm milk. One thing that helped was that I weighed only 70 pounds. Of course, the big danger was that if the horses did not stay side by side, there wouldn't be any saddle there for me to come down into. After the first few days, though, both roans knew the trick just as well as we did, so from there on we practiced without the jockey pole. At first, I did not want to tell Father anything about our new tricks, or that High and I were planning to ride in the Labor Day roundup. I was afraid he might say it was taking unnecessary chances. Every time I thought about it, I'd feel sneaky and remember about the day I stole that chocolate bar and what he had said to me out there by the chopping block. I'd think about how much I'd like to have him walk out to the gate with me and say, "So long, partner," when I went back to Cooper's Sunday nights. So I told him that first Saturday night after the 4th of July, before I even got the saddle off of Sky High. I did not tell him just what the tricks were, but I did say that High would look out that I did not get hurt. Mother did not want me to ride in the roundup, but I kind of think Father did. He didn't really tell me I could until the last Sunday, and then he didn't really tell me. There was a paper that everybody had to sign before they could go into the contests. It was something about riding at your own risk, and I was not old enough to sign it, so Father would have to if I was going to ride. I did not say a word about it, and he didn't either, until we were out milking that Sunday night. Then I heard the milk stop singing in his bucket, and he passed the paper to me down under Brindle's belly. All he said was, "You'd better ride on over to Cooper's tonight. I may want to get an early start in the morning." Always, when I went back to Cooper's on Sunday nights, I'd put Sky High on the big corral and go right on in to the bed. There was always a poker game going on in the bunkhouse, and Father did not like me to hang around out there. It was just after dark when I got back that night, and there was only a dim light in the bunkhouse. After I had hung up my saddle and started for the house, High called to me from the bunkhouse door. "Hey, come on over here, little britches. Bill Engel left a box here for you." Bill Engel was the express driver to Morrison, but I couldn't imagine why he'd have a box for me. When I got over there, there wasn't any poker game, and all 3 lanterns were turned down low. I thought High was all alone, but when I went through the door, fellows poured out of every bunk and started yelling, "Surprise, surprise!" High grabbed me up in his arms, and Mr. Cooper turned up the lanterns. There was a big package setting in the middle of High's bunk. It had Sears Roebuck in big printing across one corner, and the lettering on the tag was so big I could see it before High got me halfway over there. It said, Little Britches, care of the YB Ranch, Littleton, Colorado. My hands were shaking so I could not untie the strings, and High had to cut them with his knife. There was everything in that box that I ever hoped to have, and it was all just my size. There were a pair of mountain goat chaps with long white hair, a 10-gallon light tan hat, Spanish high-heeled boots with pointed toes, and a peach-colored silk shirt with a bright red neck scarf. I didn't find the silver spurs till High told me to look in the box again. It must have been 10 o'clock before the fellows got done making me try all of the things on, then let me go to bed. And then I could not go to sleep for a very long time. High took me to Littleton early Labor Day morning, and I wore all my new cowboy clothes. He wanted Sky High to get used to town noises and hearing the band play, so he wouldn't be nervous when it came our turn to ride. Sky spooked and crow-hopped a little the first time we rode up Main Street, and it took him quite a while to get used to the band. They hadn't had one at 4th of July. By 11 o'clock, he had quieted down, so we put both roans in the livery stable while we went up to the hotel and had dinner. High had fixed it up with Father to meet us there, and when we came out after eating, our spring wagon was standing right in front of the hotel steps. Mother and all the youngsters were there, and I don't know when I was any more glad to see them all. I had hoped Father would come to see me ride, but I had not ever thought he'd bring the whole family clear down there. I knew Mother would have a fit if she ever knew what kind of stunts we were going to do, and I wasn't a bit sure Father would like it either. Of course, if he had asked me, I would have told him, but he did not ask. Each rider or team in the trick-riding contest had to draw a number out of a hat to see when they would get their turn. We drew the highest number, so we had to be the last. There were some real good tricks, a lot better than the 4th of July. The nearer it came to our turn, the more nervous I got, and I think I would have chewed all my fingernails off if I had not been standing right there beside me. I was sure we couldn't win one of the prizes with all of those fancy trick riders, and once or twice I almost wished that something would happen so we wouldn't have to ride at all. Every nerve in me was singing like the telegraph line on a cold night, when the man with the megaphone hollered,
Hi Beckman and Little Britches on Sky Blue and Sky High, representing the YB spread.
Then we rode out onto the racetrack. High couldn't help seeing how nervous I was, and the first two or three tricks we did were the easy ones we had shown Father and Mother at home. I don't know when I got over being nervous, but after the easy tricks were finished, I forgot all about the grandstand being there. Trick riding doesn't take nearly as smart a fellow as most people think. But it does take smart horses, and we had them. Sky High and Sky Blue didn't make a misstep anywhere, and everything went as if we had been practicing for years. We saved the dive trick for the end, and when we raced up toward the center of the grandstand, dived, and bowed, it sounded as if all the Indians in the world were practicing war whoops together. I was lucky. I came clear over onto my feet, and my hat stayed on all the way. I swept it off the way High did when I bowed. Father must have thought I was going to get hurt because he had come down from the grandstand, and when I looked around, I saw him standing by the track gate. I guess I forgot where I was, and about High and Sky Blue, because I dropped my reins and went running down to him. I think I expected him to scoop me up in his arms the way he used to when I was only 6 or 7 years old. But he didn't. He just stuck out his hand and shook mine, and then he said,
Better get your horse, partner. I think the judges are going to call you.
But his voice had that silver bell sound in it. I was nearly back to where High was bringing the horses when the man with the megaphone hollered,
First place in the trick-riding contest, Hi, Beckman and Little Britches of the YB Spread. Hi, bring Little Britches on over here to the judges' stand.
Most of the men in both Arapaho and Jefferson counties must have come over to the judges' stand while they were giving Hi and me our gold watches, and I shook so many hands that my arm ached. Mother was still wiping her eyes when Father and I went up into the grandstand to show her my watch. I guess it would have been better if I had told her a little more about our new tricks before we did them. Grace said Mother thought I was going to get killed every minute and was scared nearly out of her wits. I let all of the other youngsters, even Hal, hold my gold watch and listen to it tick. And after the bucking contest was over, and Hi had won another watch, we all went up to the drugstore, and Father bought everybody an ice cream soda. It was the first one I ever had, and I liked it even better than birch beer or sarsaparilla. Grace and the other youngsters liked theirs, too, and so did Father, but I think Hi would rather have had a whiskey. Chapter 29. We Face It. Things didn't change much at Cooper's during the rest of September, but they had not been going so well over to our place. Father would not talk much about the court trial, except to say that it would probably be long and drawn out. But Fred Altland told me more about it one night when he was over to see Mr. Cooper. He said Father had rigged some sort of a recording gauge at the head gate of the ditch, so they were going to be able to prove in court how much water had been stolen by the water hogs. He said our neighbors were lucky we had moved there, because if it weren't for Father's agreement and the gauge, they would never be able to win damages in court for the crops that they had lost. He told Mr. Cooper that Father was going to show his gauge readings in court the next day, and that the water hogs were going to be the most surprised men in the world. I left Cooper's as early as I could the next Saturday night and got home just before sunset. Father and I put Sky High in the corral and fed him. Then we stood out there by the corral gate quite a while and watched him eating. I don't know just how long we were out there, but it must have been 10 or 15 minutes. We didn't talk. We just stood there, leaning on the gate and watching Sky eat. Father was different from most people. You did not have to talk much to visit with him. After a while, I told him what Fred had said about our neighbors being lucky we had moved there, and asked him to tell me about his recording gauge at the ditch head. He said it was nothing but an old coal oil can that he had rigged so that the flow of ditch water past a paddle wheel would make it turn clear around in a week. Then he had rigged a float with a pencil fixed to an arm. As the water rose or fell, the pencil moved up or down on the paper that he had wrapped around the can. He said he had shown the readings in court. The jury had been up there to test it and had found it to be accurate, so he thought our case would turn out all right. Mother came to the back door and called us in to supper just as he finished telling me about the gauge, so we started to go and get washed up. The washpan and a bucket of water were on the back porch. I had dipped up a pan of water and was just ready to reach for the soap when we heard what sounded like a couple of gunshots down the road. It wasn't, though. It was a horseless carriage, the first one that had ever come up the wagon road since we had lived there. We called Mother and the youngsters out onto the porch to watch it coming. It was a two-seater, black, with a round hood over the engine. After it crossed the bridge at the gulch, it banged a couple of more times as it chugged up the road toward our house. There were two men in the front seat and two more in the back. When it was almost up to the front of the house, I saw one of the men in the back seat lean over, grab up a gun, and swing it toward us. Father leaped like a horse going into a low buck and knocked everybody over but me. I guess I just got bewildered and stood there. Not more than a tenth of a second before the first bullet ripped a hole in the bunkhouse, Father grabbed my arm and yanked me down. There were two more shots. The second one could not have missed his head by an inch. The carriage did not stop, but kept right on up the road. Mother fell back against the kitchen when Father hit her, and all of the youngsters except Grace and me were crying, but Father didn't pay any attention to us. He jumped over Mother as she was getting up, and it seemed less than 2 seconds before I heard him firing from the front of the house. By the time I got around there, there was nothing but a cloud of dust a quarter of a mile up the wagon road, and Father was standing with his empty six-gun in his hand. He reloaded it as he ran to the corral for Lady. I saw that he was going after them, so I ran to the front gate. Lady streaked through before I had it more than half open, and I never saw such a look as was on Father's face. It was getting to be deep twilight, but it was still light enough so I could see the dust cloud turn south along the road between our place and Fred Altland's. It seemed ages before I saw the other puff of dust that Lady's feet made when she turned the corner. Father did not come back for over an hour. Mother would not let me take Sky High to go after him, but she was as worried as I was. She hadn't even cried when Father knocked her over, but before he got back she had bitten her underlip till it was bleeding. She let me stay in the house with her, but she didn't light a lamp and made all of the other youngsters go down into the storm cellar. When Father did get home, he had Fred Altland and Jerry Alder with him. They did not come from the west, though, but from the east, and they were wearing their six guns. Father said the automobile had gone clear around our section and headed north on the West Denver Road. He said it went so fast that he doubted if a man on horseback could have kept up with it for 100 yards, and that it was probably hidden away already in some barn in Denver. He told Mother that Carl Henry had ridden to Fort Logan for the sheriff, and then he asked her to get his camera out of the trunk. He had Fred and Jerry take gunpowder out of a dozen or so cartridges while he was cleaning the camera and putting the plate in it. I wanted to go out to the wagon road with them while they took a flashlight picture of the wheel tracks, but Father told me I'd better stay in the house with Mother because her nerves were all jangled up. The sheriff came and looked at the wheel tracks and at the holes in our bunkhouse. He knew me right away and asked if I had got any more pheasants. We sat down to supper while everybody was there, but the sheriff was the only one who ate much of anything. He said he would come back the next morning and get the camera plate after Father had developed it, but that all automobile tires looked alike, so he didn't think there would be a Chinaman's chance of ever tracing it down. Father had already said he had never seen any of the men in the horseless carriage before, but Fred kept asking him if he was sure one of them wasn't this or that rancher from up near the head of the ditch. Of course, everybody was pretty sure that the shooting was because Father had proof in court about the water stealing, but the sheriff said there was nothing we could do unless we could prove it, and we never could. Haying was over at Cooper's in early September, and until school started at the end of the month, I worked at the mountain ranch with High. It was fall branding time, and High was too busy to spend much time with me. I was homesick. Of course, I knew that if somebody was going to shoot at Father again, my being there wouldn't stop him. But I got it in my head so much that I couldn't think about anything else, and 2 or 3 times High had to scold me a little because I forgot to take water to the fellows up in the canyons. I had been so busy thinking about riding in the Labor Day roundup that I did not notice things around our place the way I should have. It wasn't until I came home that middle Saturday night in September that I noticed that Billy was gone. I might not have even noticed it then if it hadn't been for milking. Lots of fellows don't like to milk, but I always did. It seemed as if milking was the time when Father and I were kind of away by ourselves, and as if he belonged just to me. He always saved milking on Saturday nights till I got home. Right after supper that night, Father picked up the big bucket, the one he always used for the Holstein, and lit the lantern. When I started to pick up Brindle's bucket, he said, "Grace is curious to know how you tell which calves on the open range should be branded with the YB mark. Suppose you tell her while I do the milking. I'll only be a jiffy." And then he put the lantern over his arm and went out. I knew right then that there was something wrong, so I told Mother I'd have to water Sky High before I left him for the night. It was a story, though, and I never did it. I went right out to the barn where Father was milking. Brindle wasn't there. Father heard me come in the door, and I guess he knew what I was thinking, as he always did. He had his head against Holstein's side, and he didn't look up. He said,
"Old Holstein's holding up so well this fall that it'd be a waste of fodder for us to keep two cows. So I let Mr. Cash have Brindle."
It was then I noticed I was standing right in Billy's stall, and it was dry and clean. I don't believe I even thought before I said,
"Did he take Billy, too?"
Father didn't say anything till he got done stripping Holstein, but the bunches of muscles were working out and in on the side of his jaw. Then he set the bucket over and turned around on the milking stool so he was looking right at me.
"Partner, we might as well look it right in the face. We're not going to make it here. We haven't enough feed to see two head of stock through the winter, and I haven't had but 5 days outside work all summer. The court has only given us damages for 10 acres of crops, and that's all we're entitled to, because we have rights to only 10 inches of water. It won't amount to much more than you've earned with Mr. Cooper."
I wanted to say something, but I couldn't think of anything to say, so I just stood there. In a minute, Father hung the milk stool up on the peg and rumpled up my hair.
"Don't worry about it, son. And let's not worry, Mother. There's always a living in this world for the fellow who's willing to work for it. And I guess we are willing, aren't we? Let's go in and pop some corn."
Fred Altland brought me home from Cooper's the last Saturday before school started. He was there at the home place when I came in from the mountain ranch, and waited for me to change my clothes and get my things together. Fred and Mr. Cooper were talking out by the cook shack while I was getting my things packed. It was hot, and the window was open, and Fred was talking so loud I couldn't help hearing him.
"Damn bullheaded Yankee! God and everybody knows we'd never get a dime for our crops if he hadn't rigged that water gauge at the ditch head. And there he stands, with $120 in his hand for a year's work, too damn proud to take a bale of hay from a neighbor. Now what are you going to do with a man like that?"
I knew he was talking about Father, and I knew Father would not like it, so I grabbed up my suitcase and went out without even saying goodbye to Mrs. Cooper. Father did not get home that Saturday night until after I did. He was helping a man build a house over west of Denver. From then till Christmas, he just came home Saturday nights and left before daylight Monday morning. He did stay home a few days in the middle of December, though. Hal got pneumonia on my 11th birthday, and until Dr. Stone said he would get all right again, Father did not go back to work. I never did know who bought Nig or Lady's 2-year-old colt or the wagons and the harness. Grace told me who had bought some of our things, but all she knew about the others was that Father had taken them away and had not brought them back. I never asked him, because I knew he would not want to talk about it. When the West Denver job was finished, he let me stay home from school one day, and we went down to Fort Logan to settle up the grocery bill with Mr. Green. It was $86, and Father let me put my last check from Mr. Cooper in on it. Just before Christmas, he got another job. That time it was helping build a house in Littleton. It seemed as though our best Christmases were the ones when we were the poorest. Mother had saved a turkey, and we had all of the things to go with it. Packages came from our folks back in New England, and Father must have brought the tree with him when he came home on Christmas Eve. Mother had it trimmed with cranberries and popcorn strung together on long strings, and there were half a dozen oranges hanging from the limbs like colored lanterns. The presents were wrapped in white tissue paper and tucked in under the tree the way they always were. There was one sled with Grace and Muriel's name on it, and another for us boys. And everybody got new shoes and stockings. It snowed all Christmas afternoon, and nobody came to call. Mother had made a big plate of fudge, and we popped fresh corn and divided the oranges into sections. We had to do it that way because there were only 6 oranges, and there were 7 of us. At first, Father said for us not to divide them because they always made his teeth sting, but Mother just laughed at him, and we divided them anyway. I did not see him squinting up his eye when he ate some of the sections, either. Mother got a new book for Christmas called When Knighthood Was in Flower. She must have read us 100 pages of it that afternoon and into the evening. Chapter 30. We Moved to Littleton. We moved to Littleton between Christmas and New Year's. Father and Mother found a 7-room house on the south edge of town, and Fred Altland helped us move. There was a barn and a chicken house and a little piece of ground where we could have a garden. Besides King, we took Lady, Babe, and the chickens with us. We did not live very far from the schoolhouse, and Mother took us over the first day after New Year's. It seemed to us like an awfully big school. There was a separate room for each grade. After the principal had asked us some questions and had us read to him, he put Grace in the 8th grade and me into the 6th. Muriel went into 4th grade, and Philip in the 2nd. Starting school in Littleton wasn't a bit like starting in at the ranch. Of course, I did not know any of the kids, but they all knew who I was. I guess there had been something in the paper about my riding in the roundup. It was right after we moved to Littleton that Father was made boss on the house-building job. I don't think I ever saw him more pleased about anything. He told us about it one night when we were eating supper. I knew he had been worrying about the house because I heard him tell Mother the framing wasn't true and there'd be trouble when they went to put the roof on. That night at supper, he told us the owner had come out and caught them splicing rafters that had been cut too short. Mother took a quick little breath and said,
"Charlie, does that mean?"
Father looked up and smiled.
"Yes, ma'am, that means that he made me boss carpenter. I'm getting $4 a day, and I know I can make a good job of it."
He took a couple more mouthfuls, and then he looked up again.
"How does that line near the end of Hamlet go? The one about there being a divinity?"
Mother knew them all, I guess. She got tears in her eyes and in her voice, too.
"There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will."
Father nodded.
"Well, that's the one. How do you remember them all, ma'am?"
I think that pleased her as much as the $4 a day. I had gone to school in Littleton about 6 weeks before I got into any big trouble. The teacher in our room was a widow. She was almost a Mrs. Corcoran kind of woman. I don't think she ever said anything nice if she could find a way to say it mean. The only times she was really pleasant were when Mr. Purdy brought eggs and butter to her. Mr. Purdy was a widower who lived 4 or 5 miles up the Platte River, and he used to bring the eggs and butter during school. Sometimes they would stand at the door of the schoolroom for nearly half an hour, whispering and giggling to one another. Mr. Purdy came to the door one day in February, just after recess, and just after they had put new gravel on the schoolyard. The yard was wet, and we had all lugged gravel in on the soles of our shoes. When Mr. Purdy had talked with Mrs. Upson for nearly 15 minutes, one of the boys started to scuff his feet back and forth. Inside of a minute, everybody in the room was scuffing, and it sounded like 40 steam engines all puffing away at once. Mr. Purdy left in a hurry, and Mrs. Upson went flying out after him. She was back in 2 minutes with the principal, but the room was as quiet as if it had been empty. The principal was a big, handsome man with wavy brown hair and red cheeks. I don't suppose he was more than a year or so younger than Father. Probably 32 or 33, but he did not look within 10 years of being as old. He stood up in front of the class and clapped his hands and then said,
"I want all the children who scraped their feet to stand up."
Dutch Gunther was the first one up, and his brother, Bill, was right behind him. When I looked around, there were 7 of us boys standing, not one single girl. There must have been 30 of us in the class, and if the principal had bothered to look, he would have seen scratch marks on the floor under every desk. He folded his arms and glared at us for a couple of minutes, and then he said,
"I might have known. The worst boys in the whole school. You, follow me."
He marched out of the room like one of the drill sergeants over at Fort Logan, and we marched right after him. When we were going through the coat corridor, Dutch whispered back to me,
"Don't let him make you holler, little britches."
He led us down to a room in the basement and took a whip off a hook on the wall. It was a mean-looking whip. It was like a bullwhip, except that it was only about a foot and a half long, and it had three cattails at the end. Bill got 14 licks before he hollered, and three afterward. I didn't do so well. I had cracked a couple of ribs at the time we lost Fanny, and knobs had grown over the cracks. The first time he swung the whip, the cattails hit right over the knobs, and it felt as if I were being stabbed by a dozen broken bottles. I thought Mother would go wild when I got home. She would have gone right over to the schoolhouse if I had not told her it would only make it worse for me. She washed the places where the cracker cut through my skin, put some salve on them, and put me to bed. Afterward, she brought me up some brandy with sugar and water, but it did not taste as good as it used to, and my back was so sore I had to lay on my stomach. She must have told Father as soon as he got home from work. He had not been in the house more than a few minutes when I heard him coming up the stairs. After he said,
"Hello, son,"
he turned down the bedclothes and looked at my back. I could not have told by the sound of his voice or what he said, but I knew he was mad because those muscles at the sides of his jaws were working out and in. After he had looked at all the welts, he said,
"Gave you a good one, didn't he? Well, you've been hurt worse than this and got over it. I guess you'll live. Let's get some clothes on and go down to supper."
While I was dressing, he sat on the edge of my bed and said,
"You know, son, sometimes a fellow has to take a licking for doing the right thing. A licking only lasts a short while, even if it's a hard one, but failing to do the right thing will often make a mark on a man that will last forever. Let's go down now and eat."
Father's house was pretty nearly finished. At supper, he said there would only be about another week's work, but a man had come to see him about building another, and he was going to start on it in the 10th of March. He talked more at supper than I had heard him talking for a long time, but he did not say a word about my getting a whipping at school. Grace started to say something about it, but he kept right on talking about the house, so she had to keep still. Mother sent us all to bed as soon as the dishes were done, but I couldn't go to sleep. I must have lain there about an hour when I heard Father go out of the front door. It was about an hour before I heard him coming back. He called me to get up at the regular time in the morning, and when we were eating breakfast, I noticed that his hands were all swollen up and dark-looking across the backs. I wondered what he had been doing, because I was sure I would have noticed if they had been swollen like that when he was talking to me the night before. I thought I could figure it out if I could find out where he had been, so I asked him if I didn't hear him go out somewhere. He was wiping syrup off of his plate with a piece of hot biscuit and said,
"Oh, I just had to go see a fellow about a dog."
Mother looked up quickly and said,
"I think you got it backwards."
But Father just kept wiping up the syrup. Grace had gone back after school and got my coat and cap, and Mother did not say anything about not going to school, so I went. I think I must have gone past the principal's office 7 or 8 times that day, but I never saw him. The door of his office was always open, but he was never in there. He was not there for several more days either. The kids said somebody had given him an awful beating, but I guess I was the only one who ever had an idea who that somebody might be. I never even told Grace. Father finished his house on the 5th of March. I remember the date as well as if it had been yesterday. Ever since we had moved to Littleton, Father had been planning to fix Mother's chicken house, but he was never home in daylight except on Sundays. The first day after his job was finished, he started on the chicken house. I went out to help him as soon as I got home from school. He must have been thinking about the licking I got from the principal,
because I had only been working a little while when he said, "You're getting to be quite a man now, son. You are well past 11 years old, and you can do quite a few things better than a good many men. I'm going to treat you like a man from now on. I am never going to spank you again or scold you for little things, and someday it's going to be Moody and Sons, building contractors."
Chapter 31. So long, partner.
I had never known Lady's oldest colt much till we moved to Littleton, because Father had always pastured her away from our place. After we moved to Littleton, he began gentle breaking her on Sundays. There really wasn't much to it. She was a beautiful 1,000-pound sorrel, and as gentle as Lady. By the time Father finished his house-building job, he could drive her almost anywhere. The morning after we fixed the chicken house, he was talking about her at breakfast. Lady had not had a colt the year before and wasn't going to have one that year. Mother said it was a shame not to be raising a colt after the good price we got for Lady's last one. Father looked up and said,
"What would you think about Bab? I've been thinking I might drive her up to Fort Logan this afternoon. Judge Rucker's got a horse up there that I think might make a good husband for her."
I hadn't been home from school more than 5 minutes that afternoon before Dr. Stone brought Father. They were leading Babe behind the buggy, and there were wire cuts on her shoulder and off foreleg. Father had court plaster on the side of his face, and his arms weren't in the sleeves of his coat. When he got out of the buggy, I could see that his leg was bandaged. His overalls were torn half off one leg, and the bandage showed through. Mother, Grace, and I ran out to meet them. We were scared to death, but Father grinned and said it was nothing, that he had just been scratched a little. Dr. Stone did not talk that way, though. He said it was lucky that Father was still alive. After he and Mother had put Father to bed, they came out into the kitchen, and Dr. Stone told us what had really happened. There were big iron gates at the entrance to Fort Logan, and brick walls ran back both ways. Anyone driving on the road outside the wall could not see a team coming out of the fort till it came through the gate. Father and Babe had been almost up to the entrance when a horseless carriage came racing out of the fort. Babe had never even seen one before and reared. The man who was driving the machine tried to stop it, but it went into a fit of backfiring. Babe whirled off of the road and plunged into a gully with a barbed wire fence running through it. Father was thrown out when the buggy upset, but jumped up and flung his weight onto Babe's head so as to keep her from destroying herself in the wire. He was badly bruised and torn before he could quiet her. That summer on the ranch, without any crops and only a few days of haying, had been good for Father's lungs. Until the night he was hurt, I don't think I had heard him cough in months. But that night, I could hear him long after I had gone to bed. It must have been that he got his chest squeezed when he was wrestling with Babe down there in that gully. Father called me as usual the next morning, but he looked bad when I came down to breakfast. Where it wasn't skinned, his face was gray, and he had a little hacking cough that sounded as if it started clear in the bottom of his lungs. It was one of those cold, drizzly March mornings, and Mother wanted him to go back to bed, but he wouldn't. He said he had promised the undertaker he could dig a grave that day, and it might be his only chance to build a house that would last until doomsday. Mother did not like it, and said that was no time for banter, because if he worked out in the rain in this condition, he might be digging his own grave. Father chuckled a little when he got up from the table, and he rumpled my hair.
"Well, we Moodies are tough fellows, aren't we, son?"
Before he went out, he laid his hand on Mother's shoulder and said,
"Don't worry, ma'am. I'm not sick. I'm just scratched up a little. This job will only take half a day, and there's $3 in it."
The job did take longer than half a day. I had been out of school an hour before Father got home. Mother had him put on dry clothes on the right way and made him drink some brandy and some hot water. I don't know whether it was the brandy that made Father talk that night or whether he had a premonition. He had never told us youngsters anything about his boyhood or the things he had done before we were old enough to remember. That night we sat at the table for nearly 2 hours while Father told us about the little backwoods farm in Maine where he was brought up by his deaf-mute father and mother, and about going to visit his uncle's family when he was 8 years old so that he could learn to talk with his mouth as well as his fingers. He told us about grafting apple boughs into birch trees, about lowering himself down into the well so he could see the stars in the daytime. But he did not tell us anything about being the New England bicycle racing champion. Mother told me about that afterwards. I heard him coughing every time I woke up during that night, and the next morning he stayed in bed. The doctor from Littleton came that evening and said Father had pneumonia. He was so sick that the doctor would only let us go in to see him once during the next week. Mother had sent us all to take a long walk on Sunday afternoon so as to get us out from underfoot. She had spent almost every hour with Father since he was taken sick, and her nerves were so unstrung that we were irritating her. When we came home from our walk, the doctor said we could each go in and see Father for just a minute. Grace went first, and then it was my turn. He looked so bad it frightened me when I went into the room. I couldn't think of a thing to say, and I guess Father was so sick he couldn't either. I had found a coil of inch rope laying beside the road when we had been walking, and brought it home. I could only think to tell Father about the rope. He raised his hand up a little, and I took it. His voice was almost a whisper, and he said,
"You take care of it, partner. You may need it."
That was the last thing I ever heard him say. Afterwards, Mother told me he had asked for me his last day, but the doctor would not let her send to school for me. When we got out of school at noon, 10 days after Father was taken sick, Hal was waiting for us with a note. The doctor had sent a nurse to help Mother for the past few days, and the note was in her handwriting. It said for us to go to the Roberts' house for our lunch and not to come home. They lived a block nearer to the schoolhouse than we did, and were good neighbors to us. They had the only telephone in the neighborhood, and while we were eating, the nurse came in to use it. I think it was Cousin Phil she called. After she had told us who she was, she said,
"We've got to have a tank of oxygen out here right away." "Yes." "Yes, it's got to be here right away if it's going to do any good."
Hal was waiting for us with another note when school let out. That one named a different house for us to go to until Mother sent for us. I was to go to the Roberts. When I got there, Mrs. Roberts gave me a piece of bread and jam. I was standing just outside the parlor door eating it when the nurse came in. She did not say anything to Mrs. Roberts or to me, but walked right across the parlor and cranked the telephone. I thought it might be something more about oxygen, so I stepped over where I could hear better. The nurse spoke a number into the telephone, and in a minute, she told who she was and said she was talking for Mother. And then she said,
"Her husband died about 20 minutes ago. You better pick up the body right away. I want to get rid of it as soon as we can. Her nerves are going all to pieces."
It was too big for me to take all at once like that. I didn't feel like crying. I didn't feel like anything. My brain just stopped working for a minute or two. When it started up again, it was going around and around like a stuck gramophone cylinder, and was saying over and over,
"So long, partner. So long, partner. So long, partner."
Bessie and Mrs. Altman came to stay with Mother that night, and we youngsters stayed where the note had told us to go. My mind was sort of numb during the days between Father's death and the funeral. Things that happened still seem unreal. I do remember that I got a new blue serge suit, the first suit I'd ever had that Mother didn't make, but I don't remember where it came from. All of our old neighbors from the ranch were at Father's funeral, and I never knew till then how much they really cared for him. After the services, Dr. Brown glanced at Mother's red-streaked hand and said,
"Mrs. Moody, that is surgeon's blood poisoning. If you are ever to raise Charlie's children, you must come home with me at once."
Everybody was shocked except Mother. She was a small woman, and Dr. Brown was a very large man. She looked up into his face and said,
"Yes, Doctor, I know. I believe I have no choice in the matter."
All our neighbors, both from the ranch and from Littleton, pressed around, offering to take us youngsters in. Cousin Phil said something about writing our other relatives in New England. For just one moment, Mother's eyes flashed, then she was calm again.
"No, Phil. I am sure Charlie wants us all to be together."
And then she parceled us out to nearer neighbors, being sure that Hal went where there was a good cow, and that Muriel went to a motherly woman without too many youngsters of her own. At the end, she said to me,
"Son, I want you to stay with Laura Pease, where you will be near home and can take care of Lady and the hens. Tomorrow, you take Babe over to Mr. Hockaday and tell him Father would have wanted him to have her. He needs a good horse, and he's a fine, honest man. He will pay us all that she is worth."
And then she thanked our neighbors and kissed each of us all around, leaving me until the last. I remember how my lip trembled, wondering if I were the least. She did not cry until she put her hand on my head and said,
"You are my man now. I shall depend on you. Mother will be home in 2 weeks."
It was not 2 weeks, but 4. At the end of the first week, before Dr. Brown was sure he would not have to amputate the arm, Mother sent for Grace and me. Grace had her 13th birthday 2 days after Father died. We harnessed Lady to the spring wagon and drove to Denver, stopping by the river to gather a bouquet of pussy willows. At Dr. Brown's big house on Capitol Hill, we were only allowed to see Mother for a few minutes. She was so thin we hardly knew her. Her eyes were deep in their sockets with black circles around them, and for the first time I noticed white in her hair. Her voice was very low, almost a whisper. She put her good hand out to us and smiled.
"Mother, it's going to be all right. I have talked to the Lord a lot about it. He knows you need me, and with him and Dr. Brown, I shall be all right."
Dr. Brown started to lead us from the room. When we had reached the door, Mother called me back. She took my hand and said,
"The peas should have been planted on St. Patrick's Day. You know where the seeds are in the barn loft? Soak them overnight, and put plenty of hen manure deep in the trench."
I don't know why that made me cry, when I had not before. But from that moment, I was sure Mother was coming home. It was late in the afternoon of a pleasant mid-April day when they brought Mother home. Cousin Phil drove her out in his first automobile, a 2-cylinder Buick with shiny brass rods to support the windshield. Dr. Brown and a nurse came with them. They carried Mother into the house and put her to bed downstairs in the parlor. When I came in, she was saying to the nurse,
"I am perfectly all right now. All I need is my children."
As quickly as I could get out, I harnessed Lady to the spring wagon and started the collection of brothers and sisters. Mother could be quite persuasive, if necessary. She must have been so with Dr. Brown, because just as we turned into the lane, the Buick was pulling away from our house. Dr. Brown and the nurse waved to us from the back seat as they went by. I was the last one into the house, because I had to unhitch Lady. Most of the tears were shed before I got there, and Mother was propped up in bed with Hal still sobbing and trying to bury his nose in her side. Her right hand was heavily bandaged. When I came in, she organized the first meeting of the clan of Moody.
"Now, let's not be sorry for ourselves any more," she said. "We've got lots of things to do. First, we must get Mother's hand well. All it will take is good food and good care. I can't think of anything that would be better for it right now than a good chicken stew. Ralph, suppose you dress that big, fat, buff Orpington hen that didn't lay last winter. Philip, you get Grace 2 or 3 armfuls of wood and some shavings so she can start a fire in the cook stove. Muriel, do you think you could get the new tablecloth out of the dresser drawer and set us a table right here up by my bed? When you get the fire going, Grace, put on the big iron pot with some fat in it so it will be good and hot when the hen is ready. And Hal, would you get Mother a drink of water? I can't think of a thing that would taste so good as a nice, cool dipper of water right from our own well.
That first supper was the most memorable meal of my life. The big yellow mixing bowl set in the middle of the table, filled to the brim with well-browned pieces of chicken, stewed until it was almost ready to fall off of the bones, whole potatoes and carrots with big puffy dumplings mixed at the bedside, floating on top. Father had always said grace before our meals. Always the same 25 words, and the ritual was always the same. Mother would look around the table to see that everything was in readiness, then she would nod to Father. That night, she nodded to me, and I became a man. This concludes Little Britches, Father and I Were Ranchers, by Ralph Moody. From Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.